For the week of December 15th, 2013, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 217, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And Adam McDonald's near Valdosta, Georgia, I'm Michael Gills.
Okay, I don't know. You're only at a McDonald's for the Wi-Fi, correct? You're not.
I haven't moved into a McDonald's, no.
No, okay. So, because, you know, on our last show, you said you were hungry, so I thought maybe you went to McDonald's. But why Georgia?
That would not happen.
Yeah, I guess you're headed home for the holidays.
Visiting friends and relatives, taking a tour of the South. Nashville, Atlanta, Tampa, Gainesville, Atlanta again, and then Birmingham, Alabama for Christmas.
And thus the reason for your sound quality for this particular episode. But I'm sure our listeners will bear with us as we go over this week's news.
I guess, and what is this week's news?
Well,
death.
Yeah, I guess we should talk about Peter O'Toole. The star of Lawrence of Arabia died on Sunday at the age of 81. I can't remember the last time he starred in a film. It was Venus, I believe.
Well, that was just a few years ago. Yeah, he's done some TV work still. He was 81, which isn't that old, but he's, you know, had a great long career, of course. My Favorite Year, one of his last great movies. But he was followed very quickly by Joan Fontaine, who also died. A couple of very good supporting character actors. And then Tom Laughlin, who played Billy Jack, which was the iconic role in the 70s. And he was an early innovator in four-walling, which is where you paid the movie theater in order to show your film, and then you got all the profits. You just gave them a flat fee. And then you got the profits. Mario Van Peebles did it with Melvin Van Peebles, I should say, did it with Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. Tom Laughlin continued that into the 70s. Nowadays, it's sort of a trend that has fallen by the wayside for a lot of technical reasons. But it was an interesting innovation at the time where you could get around studios, you know, who didn't want to make your movie, didn't want to release it. Well, you know, he made them all laugh because he made a lot of money off Billy Jack.
With Joan Fontaine, of course, she won an Oscar for her role in, or no, she was nominated as Best Actress for her role in Rebecca, and 3 years later for Edmund Goulding's The Constant Nymph, but she won, and I'm trying to remember, Suspicion, I believe, was,
yes.
Was yeah, and there was all this rivalry between her older sister, Olivia de Havilland, and her, and everybody played it up again, how many umpteen years later?
Well, and she insisted it wasn't true. We got along great, but give me a break.
Yeah, breaking news. The real inside scoop on Olivia de Havilland and Joan Fontaine's bitter rivalry. And I thought, why am I getting this email from the Hollywood Reporter?
Because she's dead.
Well, no, I understand that, but it was like 3 days later I was getting it.
Well, there you go. Well, anyway, let's be more timely here. What are we going to talk about?
Well, on today's show, we'll go over all the Golden Globe Award nominations as if they really mattered, even though only 90-odd international journalists will actually be able to vote for them. James Cameron is betting that there is only one thing better than an Avatar sequel, and that's three sequels, and he's shooting them all in New Zealand, Land of the Hobbits. Last year, Beyonce dropped a baby. This year, the pop star has dropped a surprise new album, and surprise, it's a hit. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines, but first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire and apparently McDonald's resident, Michael Giltz, to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And the number one movie around the world is, of course, The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug. It grossed $204 million worldwide. You know, big success everywhere. It's going to be opening in Japan and some other territories later, but it's in a lot of countries, 50 different territories. And it started off with a lot of money. It's a little slower in the U.S. than the last film, even though it's gotten better reviews. It is, I would say, dramatically better than the first Hobbit film, though still not a patch on The Lord of the Rings and their quality level. Nonetheless, when all is said and done, it will probably get close to or equal the $1 billion that the first Hobbit film made.
Yes,
we'll get back to that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sorry. We're going to get back to that at the end of your...
Well, that's the main thing to talk about, so we might as well wind up with that. At number two around the world is Frozen, the Disney animated film, another $53 million. It's a $265 million worldwide. And number three, The Hunger Games, Catching Fire. Jennifer Lawrence is having a good few weeks. She's got American Hustle and limited release. And she has The Hunger Games still pulling in another $32 million around the world. That's at $730 million. And number four, a little lower than expected, is Tyler Perry's A Midea Christmas. $16 million it made. That's quite a bit lower, especially for a film starring his most famous character. But it may have legs, some people think about, because, you know, normally most people go to see his movies first weekend, but this is a holiday themed film, so perhaps this one will have better legs than he normally does. At number five is Firestorm. I think this is a Hong Kong action film starring Andy Lau. It's grossed $15 million this weekend. It's at $21 million and counting. At number six is Gravity, another $8 million. It's at $642 million. At number seven is Way Back Home, another $5 million on its opening weekend. And number eight is No Man's Land, another $4.5 million. This is one of three movies that grossed about $4 million. There's No Man's Land, which is about to hit $30 million. There's About Time, the Richard Curtiz romantic drama, which is about to hit $70 million. And there's Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs 2, or Deux, if you're in France. That's at $223 million worldwide. Then there's Thor, The Dark World. That also made $4 million. That's at $620 million worldwide. And just below that is Captain Phillips, the Tom Hanks film. That's at $205 million. And the sequel to The Four, which is The Four 2, which made $3 million. And that's at $21 million. I'm very glad that Thor, The Dark World, and The Four 2 are not right next to each other because my mouth might fall apart.
Right. And The Four 2 being a Chinese film, as are some of the other titles that you may not recognize outright.
That's right. And we've mentioned them in previous weeks.
That's right.
But Hobbit did roll out around the world. It is number one around the world. That's good bragging rights. But as Sperling has pointed out before, you probably still want to go territory by territory. No one's going to say, well, this is a bad weekend to release a movie, but I want to open it worldwide and be number one. So I'm going to release it. No, that's not how it works. You say it's Japan. All right, we're going to release it in February. You have some Latin American countries where their holidays tend to go from Christmas through New Year into the early days of January, where they still have some Christian holidays that they celebrate. And so their movie going time period more stretches past Christmas and New Year's. So that's why some Hollywood studios hold their movies until right before Christmas. So that's why The Hobbit is delayed a week in several Latin American countries. On the limited screen release here in North America, two big movies are having a limited release. That's Saving Mr. Banks, which is doing okay on 15 screens, but I still think it'll be a broadly commercial and appealing movie, especially for older audiences. And that made $28,000 per screen. But the one that really caught your attention is American Hustle, which is really hitting the momentum at the right time. It's on six screens. It grossed $116,000 per screen, which is a ton of money. And it's been getting on all the best of the year lists. It got a lot of nominations from the Golden Globes. So this movie is poised to capitalize on award season.
Well, and it has all these hot stars, Bradley Cooper and Christian Bale and Jennifer Lawrence. These are the it people of the it actors and actresses of the moment. So
that's true. And David O. Russell, talented director, his last movie, The Fighter, did very well. That's not one of my favorites of his. I do love some of his other films, but I'm eager to see this one. I haven't caught it yet.
Well, you said we were going to save talking about, and by the way, I think you're pronouncing the name of this film completely wrong because everybody knows it's The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug, or however you pronounce that dragon's
Smaug.
Name. And it
depends
looks like
if you're elvish, dwarvish, or human. That's how that depends how you pronounce it.
Well, I am human, so I'm going to say the Desolation of Smaug. And I would say you must have seen it because you're talking about it.
That's right. I did see it. I saw it in 3D IMAX. Why?
Because
I want to stay on top of technology. I want to see that one or two movies a year where people say it's worthwhile. I want to see what the latest is. And I went before noon, so it only cost me $15. So that was a pretty cheap ticket for New York City to see 3D IMAX. But I was
Now, you didn't see it 3D IMAX HFR, did you?
HFR. I'm not sure what HFR is.
High frame rate.
I did see it high frame rate. Absolutely. Of course I did.
So it looked like a little TV-ish.
I thought all the prints were high frame rate.
No, not all of them are. As a matter of fact, I know you want to talk about that, about how really Warner Brothers and the filmmakers are downplaying 48 frames per second. They shot the film at 48 frames per second using the Red Epic cameras, these new cameras from this digital, you know, professional digital camera manufacturer, which was started, by the way, by the same person who founded Oakley sunglasses and Oakley eyewear, and now, of course, Oakley, the company. He created this camera. The Red, their latest version, the Red Epic, was used to shoot The Hobbit, all three films. They shot it in 48 frames per second. Most of the screens are showing it in the standard 24 frames per second. And well, last year, a big deal was made over the fact that there was 48 frame per second screenings, or screenings known as high frame rate. And
I think the basic idea is not that they're ashamed of it or think it's a bad idea, but they didn't want people talking about their high frame rate rather than just the movie. And they thought the movie got drowned out by the technological stuff. Every review led with the high frame rate. And they're like, oh, my God, they should be talking about our film. So in this movie, they really touted the movie and tried to keep all the technology stories out of people's minds so that they wouldn't be leading with the discussion of high frame rate.
Well, you know, technology is a double-edged sword. When you have it for Avatar, and it's great, and it's fantastic, everybody talks about it. And they talk about the story, too. When you have it for The Hobbit, and it's 48 frames per second, and it doesn't necessarily look
weird,
that great,
yeah.
And people talk about it, and oh yeah, they'll talk about the story, too. Unfortunately, they're talking about how the technology didn't really work with The Hobbit. And in this film, I get the sense that they cut around awkward moments. But there were moments in 48 frames per second, and I saw it 48 frames per second, 3D, not IMAX, in Atmos. So, and okay. I saw it with CJ Flynn, who is a digital cinema consultant and expert. He was on episode 160. If you want to hear more about high frame rate, look for Showbiz Sandbox episode 160 from August of 2012, and you'll hear CJ Flynn talking about what high frame rate is and what its effect on cinema will be. And I saw it with all of the bells and whistles except IMAX, and I agree with you, it was a much better film than the first Hobbit.
Oh, dramatically speaking, yeah, no, it was a far more enjoyable movie. The first one was a train wreck, I thought, dramatically. This one is still, it's not The Hobbit. It's basically a prequel to Lord of the Rings. And I say that because The Hobbit is a very different type of story than The Lord of the Rings. It's a children's tale. It's simpler, it's humorous, it's picaresque. They've turned it into a three-film prequel to The Lord of the Rings with nonstop action. There's lots of scenes in here that are not in the book. There's Legolas is in the movie. He shouldn't be in there. He's not in the book. But taking it on its own terms, it at least is a far better movie than the first Hobbit film. And I think the high frame rate, I don't know what you two thought, but I thought they did a lot better job. I don't know whether it's rendering or how you describe it, but they dealt with the high frame rate look much better. This movie did not look weird. It still looked sharp. You could tell the difference visually. It was very easy to see I'm not looking at celluloid or digital, that this is something different. I'm looking at digital, I beg your pardon. But I am definitely looking at something different. You can notice the difference very easily. But it didn't have that cheap high video look that the first movie had. It didn't look it didn't make the sets look bad. It didn't make the things look unreal and fake. It somehow they rendered it or dealt with it in post in a much better way so that the movie had a better look, I thought.
Yes, and I think a part of that is they looked at the footage they had this year, and they cut around awkward moments. They cut around some of the images that might look a little awkward. I think that's part of it. I think the other aspect is exactly what you're saying, Michael, that they started dealing with it in post-production, timing it correctly,
because every scene in the first movie looked awful. It wasn't like there were just a few scenes that looked weird. The entire movie looked terrible. It looked weird.
Right.
This one looks more like a film.
And we had a piece on Celluloid Junkie about high frame rate in general and how it looks awkward. The movement sometimes looks awkward. It's not
that I definitely noticed. It's kind of like when you get that blurring on what kind of TV was it that you got the blurring of action? Was it plasma or the other one?
I can't remember.
In the old days, one of them would blur and one of them looked better, but it didn't handle action scenes as well. Well, in the high frame rate, when you saw the camera having to move quite a bit, you would get a bit of a blurring and it was a little disorienting and not effective. And if you weren't staring exactly right at the screen in your 3D glasses on IMAX, you would get a blurring as well. You really had to stay locked in. But I did notice with a severe camera movement or intense action that it would look not as good. And still the movie, the look in general, as far as the production design, it still looks more like a video game than the Lord of the Rings movies. The way that people move and jump, it does not feel as real as The Lord of the Rings does. However, the overall cinematography of it, however you want to describe that, the high frame rate look of the movie was definitely improved.
Right,
but
yeah.
I mean, it was interesting that they didn't even tell you what screens were doing it.
Yes.
They really kept it secret.
Well, and there are, you know, near me, there was only one screening in high frame rate. And if you wanted to see another screening in high frame rate, you had to drive 30 miles to do it. So, yes, they are not publicizing this at all, which is fine. I mean,
no one else is flocking to do it except James Cameron. So is this mean high frame rate at 48 frames per second is already a flop?
No, I think that if there's anybody that's going to do 48 frames or 60 frames per second, and some are saying you could go up to 120 frames per second, you will get that kind of video game movement in some portions of the film. You're right, it didn't look like masterpiece theater sets in The Hobbit, Desolation of Smaug. But if there's anybody that's going to get it right, it is James Cameron, and he is...
Well, yes, but is he going to lead the way? He does 3D, right? But 3D is not going to be the standard for 90% of the movies, like he thought. So is high frame rate. If they're already one film and everybody's running away from it and nobody else is flocking to do it, is this a fad that's going to... Not even a fad, it's just a couple movies. Is this something that's just going to be a little blip on the horizon, like Cinerama or, you know, surround shaking or whatever, you know, some fatty little idea of what movies should embrace that will come and go?
No, I don't think so at all. And here's why. Televisions are actually broadcasting now instead of at 30 hertz. It's, you know, they're set for 60 or 120. So I think that because televisions are capable of presenting images with higher frame rates and higher refresh rates, you will see filmmakers actually shoot that way. Now, folks and filmmakers like James Cameron and others will begin to perfect the way that technology and the way those images look on screen. It's just a matter of time. And I think, again, okay. I would and go back to, you know, CGI was kind of a thing before Terminator 2. You know, there were films that used CGI, but after Terminator 2, after James Cameron had that, like, molten man, I don't know, I can't remember the name of
the liquid Terminator.
The liquid Terminator. Yeah. Once he had done that, and once he had done, now I can't remember the name of the underwater movie he did, The Abyss.
The Abyss.
Yeah, once he did those two films, people said, wow, you can really do a lot with this CGI, and it took off. He showed people how to do it correctly. People still
and
do
it's
it.
It's been a disaster ever since.
And yeah, people still do it wrong all the time. I think with 60 frames per second, which is what he said he wanted to shoot the Avatar sequels in, I think he will either figure out a way to make high frame rate work or at the very least look good. But it does have that hyper real, surreal feel to it.
Well, I wish Peter Jackson had taken his time on the script more than the technical side. He seems to have fallen down the rabbit hole that James Cameron and George Lucas did long ago. But James Cameron, no surprise to us, he moved to New Zealand. So now we know it's official. He's going to make 3 Avatar sequels, I guess all at the same time. I'm not sure, but he's making them in New Zealand.
Yeah, I mean, there's a benefit to making them all at the same time. There are economies of scale. You don't have to break down sets and build sets again and again. For sequels, build it once for the first film and then again for the second film. But at the same time, I think there are benefits to shooting each film separately, and that is you can actually learn as you go. And for instance, Peter Jackson could have learned a little bit about high frame rate shooting the first Hobbit film, gone back and shot Desolation of Smaug possibly a different way. And I'm not saying not high frame rate. I'm just saying you whether it's using different cameras or different lighting or different. Instead, he had shot the whole thing before the first film was out.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know. I think I would tend to agree with you. I think they're probably going to shoot them all these Avatar sequels at once. They're going to cost roughly $412 million or 500 New Zealand dollars.
A bargain.
Yeah. And they announced down in New Zealand a big deal with the New Zealand government, Jim Cameron's Lightstorm Entertainment and 20th Century Fox. I guess they're getting all of these tax rebates from New Zealand, and there's this memorandum of understanding that they made public about all of these incentives that they'll get this 25% rebate, and they'll shoot all the films in the country, and they'll put like a little bit about New Zealand on the DVD and Blu-ray. And why not give that up if you're 20th Century Fox? There won't be DVDs and Blu-rays by then anyway.
I think you're confused. The $412 million is the package deal in incentives and tax breaks and other things that New Zealand is making with them.
Oh,
it's not the budget of the three films. At least that's not how I see it described here.
Yeah, and you might be right. I may be misreading that, but I thought that the deal
would be awfully cheap for three big films like this.
Yeah, you're probably right about that. Although, if you're shooting them all at once, maybe not.
Yeah. Well, will he be nominated for a Golden Globe when the first Avatar sequel comes out? Probably not.
Well, you never know. He might be. He might be nominated for a Golden Globe. He might not win. He was nominated for... Was he not nominated for a Golden Globe with the first
for Avatar?
I think he was.
I don't know. Oh, well, you may be right.
Well, this year, you know, he's not going to be nominated this year because those nominations are already out.
Mm-hmm. And of course, there are 10 movies up for Best Picture, 5 in drama, 5 in comedy, and then they have 10 actors. So they're definitely going to probably name almost everybody who's going to get a nomination in the top categories, because they have 10 films and they have 10 actors for 5 acting slots in each category. So, you know, they're going to name pretty much everybody. So these movies that you're looking at, the Golden Globes, they're roughly what we're going to be seeing come Oscar time. 12 Years a Slave, Gravity, Captain Phillips. And then you've got in the comedy section, you've got American Hustle, Her, Inside Llewyn Davis, Nebraska, Wolf of Wall Street. These are the movies that are on the best of the year list. These are the movies getting nominations, and they all are reflected in the acting categories as well. Any big surprises for you?
Well, I think we would. I noticed you skipped over these two films when you were mentioning Best Motion Picture Drama, Philomena and Rush. Philomena is a fine film. It's a great film. I enjoyed it. I think you
great,
know,
great.
Well, oh, I know you always. I throw that adjective around. Okay, that's just my crutch word. Great. It's an enjoyable film, even though it's on a tough subject. Steve Coogan, who I'm not usually a big fan of, he wrote the film, he's in the film, and he does a great job. And yes, I would use the word great for the job that Steve Coogan does in this film, Philomena. The other surprise for me was the film Rush, the Formula One Ron Howard movie.
Right. That didn't get much love from anyone. It was not a commercial or critical hit, though it is possible that in the Best Supporting Actor category, you might see the terrific actor
Daniel Brühl.
Daniel Brühl get an Oscar nomination, because I think a lot of people, it's a very flashy role. It involves tragedy and stuff. So it's this sort of memorable turn that does get recognized come Oscar time. And he's a terrific German actor who deserves more attention.
Yes, no. And he was in Inglourious Bastards, I believe.
Yes, he was.
Yes.
So, you know,
it makes sense, though, that Philomena, a film that takes place partially in Ireland and in the UK, and Rush, a film that is focused on a sport that Europe is quite fond of, that those two films would be nominated for Best Motion Picture Drama, if only because the Golden Globes are the nominations and the awards are handed out by the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. So it's 90, 95 journalists all from around the world, a lot of them from Europe.
That's right. So, you know, again, look through the list and you'll see the names that you'll probably see come Oscar time, almost definitely.
In fact, I'm seeing a lot of names I've seen before. Robert Redford, Tom Hanks, Sandra Bullock, Cate Blanchett, Emma Thompson.
You're also seeing new people like Daniel Brühl, Chiwetel Ejiofor, Idris Elba, Matthew McConaughey. He certainly hasn't gotten a lot of nomination in his career.
No.
Greta Gerwig, that was a nice pick for her, and Frances Ha. Julie Louis-Dreyfus for a feature film as opposed to television. Oscar Isaac, he's a breakthrough talent. Bruce Dern, a late career tapping. You know, it's been a long time. So, you know, there's people in there. Sally Hawkins, Lupita Nyong'o is certainly not a common list come at the end of the year. June Squibb, that's almost half the people there.
Fine. Again, I set them up just so you can tear it down.
Oh, that old name, Barkhad Abdi. Him again.
Yes, that guy.
He's the pirate from Captain Phillips. Well, there you go. So those are the list. Who cares what they do? I don't think they gained any momentum for anyone. Wolf of Wall Street, I think, is looking not great as far as award attention, but the Oscars love Scorsese, so maybe he'll come through in the end.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be getting middling reviews, meaning that it's not they're not getting horrible reviews, but it's like, yeah, it's a halfway decent Scorsese film, kind of like Casino. It wasn't a...
Ouch!
It wasn't a horrible movie, but it wasn't a great...
Casino's not a good movie.
Okay, well, I haven't seen it in, I don't know, since it was released. I haven't seen it.
Sharon Stone's like, it's his best film ever.
No. It wasn't great. See?
Sharon Stone would say.
That's true. But, you know, in a way, I only watch the Golden Globes because you're allowed to drink during the Golden Globes. If you attend, you're allowed to drink. So by the end of the Globes, they are just wacky.
Well,
and
that those days are gone. It's too highly televised and people pay too much attention now. I think the days where people got tousled on the Globes is long past.
I'm going to look that word up. I think you may have made it up. I don't know.
I might have, but so did Shakespeare.
Wow. Touché. Well, I, like I said, I don't really necessarily care who wins the Golden Globes because it's not indicative of anything. Just like I don't care who wins this television show, this competition television show, The Voice. And yet, I watched it on Monday. And Michael, why do you think I watched it on Monday?
I have no idea, but Simon Cowell's very angry with you.
Why is that?
Because he's on The X Factor.
Oh, well, yeah, I forgot about that.
And he should be very angry. Before we get into The Voice, The Voice is one of the top 5 shows in the country right now in North America. It's very successful for entertainment, but has yet to launch an actual star, you know, and people on the show win the show, or they rank second or third or fourth or fifth. They maybe sell a song or two, but nobody has really broken through and become an established act. The X Factor, however, Simon Cowell, this season, he has some of the best lineup I think I've ever seen in any of these shows, American Idol, The Voice, The X Factor. There's three or four acts that are really commercial. I think some of them are really going to break through. They've already had some success around the world with some of the acts that they've launched on The X Factor from North America. And I think he's done it again. It's been a very entertaining show, and the ratings have just collapsed. And he must be very frustrated because he finally got a decent judging panel, and he has a great lineup of talent, one of his best lineups ever. A country boy band, this male-female duo, this husband and wife called Alex and Sierra, who are probably going to win it this week. They're really interesting and certainly very commercial. They're sort of like Sonny and Cher crossed with the Civil Wars. I mean, they're talented, but they're kind of goofy too.
Well, given the way the Civil Wars turned out, and given the way Sonny and Cher turned out, I don't know.
Maybe they should avoid fame. Yes, exactly. Fame is rough on a marriage.
Exactly.
But he must be very frustrated because The Voice is bigger than ever. And The X Factor, I guess maybe because of the demos and Fox doesn't have a ton of stuff, maybe they'll be back next season, but I wouldn't be shocked if they weren't.
Well, I have not watched The Voice since it first began way back. I guess it was last year or the year before. I can't remember when it was first.
It's been a couple of years now.
Yeah, it's been a couple of years. I watched the first couple of episodes. I thought, oh, it's an interesting concept, these blind auditions where the judges don't see the person that's singing initially, and they have to then get them on their, you know, team and coach them all the way through to the win. I thought it was an interesting concept. I think it's a little flawed now because, that Adam guy, not Adam Lambert, the guy from Maroon 5.
Adam Levine, the sexiest man alive.
Adam Levine, the sexiest man alive. Yes. He,
according to People magazine.
Okay. I thought maybe you were saying that.
No, I was not.
Well, Adam Levine has two competitors on, in the final out of the final three.
Well, he was more successful.
Well, yes, but it's also very disingenuous for him to be coaching both of them and saying to the first person, oh, you're great. You're definitely going to win. That was a winning performance. You're tops. And then the next guy comes out and he says, that was great. You have a winning performance. You were tops. It's like, yeah, I don't know about this. Maybe you should have given
him. Tell them, you're a loser. The other guy's going to crush you. Give up now.
Well, he did actually
be a very good coach.
He did actually say to the guy, I wasn't really paying attention to names, to be quite honest. He did kind of say, you should feel this is a huge victory for you.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there you go. In a polite way, he was already letting him know what he thought.
Right.
So give him a break. Now tell us, why the heck were you watching the show you could tell us about?
Well, because I got an email from TiVo, and I'm one of their beta testers for new technologies at times. And they
Why not surprised?
Why are you not surprised? Well, I'm still using TiVo. That should surprise somebody. But finally, it looks like they're doing something really interesting with the technology that they've had in living rooms since 2000. They could have been doing this ages ago and should have been.
This sounds lame. They let you vote on The Voice. You use your TiVo remote to vote. My local New York One channel has been doing that for like 10 years.
Precisely. They should have been.
Why the heck?
Because they're all engineers. They're not, the people who run TiVo, they're mostly engineers and engineering based. So they're not very focused on the business aspects of the business they happen to be in. On the technology aspects, they're right there. They know it all. But now they're actually using their technology for a very good business reason. And as you said, they sent out this email that asked certain people such as myself who use TiVo and are subscribers to its service. We all had all the beta testers had a special software.
You could use your remote to vote on the show.
Yeah, we had some special software that was downloaded.
Like you can use apps. You can use apps. You can go to a website. You can dial in by phone. You can text. And now, via TiVo, you can use your remote.
Right, and so there's a thumbs up and a thumbs down button.
But I mean,
on my
God, this is ridiculous. This is 10 years after they should have been doing it.
Right, and I suppose that's the only reason I wanted to talk about it was to say, really?
And, how lame they are.
Yeah.
Well, they were lame. How is Beyonce, though? Because she created some news. A trend recently in music has been to keep an album under wraps and then release it all at once and surprise the world. There have been some smaller indie acts that have done it. And more recently, My Bloody Valentine and then David Bowie released their new albums out of the blue. People just didn't even know they were coming out. And suddenly they were available to the world. That's one of the powers of digital. Beyonce did them one better because A, she's a bigger commercial act, or at least has been, and B, she also launched with 14 videos for her 10 or 12 tracks. So she had full, lavish videos for every song on the album and released the album exclusively to iTunes for a week or two. Because, why is that, Sperling? Why did she do it digitally first before the CD came out?
I don't.
Because you can't keep it a secret if you put it out on CD, because there's no way to stop leaks if you go to a pressing plant. There's too many people involved. There's too many hands that handle the music. And they knew that if they wanted the CD out at the same time, it wasn't going to work. And so that's why the CD is not coming out until a few days before Christmas, because there was no other way to do it. So she put it out on iTunes at like midnight. Suddenly people went crazy and said, oh, it's a new Beyonce album. And, you know, frankly, she got a lot of great press, a lot of attention. She looks cool, and she sold a lot of copies, didn't she?
Yeah, I think she sold more than, I think something like 828,000 copies internationally and 617 in the U.S. alone.
Well, I'm not clear whether international means worldwide or not.
Yes, it does.
So it does. Well, it should say worldwide, because that does not mean internationally.
Oh, I see. I see what you're saying. You don't. Okay, so you're saying, is it 828,000 internationally and 617?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
That's a good question. I don't know.
I read the article. I couldn't find out. It's not clear. Either Beyonce sold 600,000 copies or she sold 1.4 million copies worldwide. We're not clear. But probably, let's say we know at least she sold 600,000 in the U.S. That's a strong first week. And frankly, her album sales have been collapsing. You know, she's had a couple really big albums. But back in 2011, she released her album 4. It only sold 3 million copies worldwide and had no top 10 hits in the U.S. So she's still a big draw on tour. And her tour is going on right now. She did this whole album and shot all these videos while the tour was happening. In fact, I know a friend who worked on one of her videos. He couldn't talk about it or tell me, but he actually helped edit and work on one of her videos. And so once it came out, then he was like, I did that.
So finally saw him because he was let out of the cage.
Yeah. That's right. But her tour is doing great. She sold $100 million in ticket sales so far. She's going overseas and coming back to the U.S. later. So she's still a big draw, but her album sales have been falling. So that's the same for everybody, of course, but certainly 3 million worldwide is pretty weak, and she wants to turn that around, and maybe the buzz and attention for the way she released this album will make her cool again.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are certain people, certain artists who can do this. Beyonce is one of them.
Everyone can do it. What do you mean?
Well, yes, but if you're like some no-name band and you decide to all of a sudden release an album on iTunes, well, nobody's going to care. Nobody's going to know. It's not going to spread virally the way this did.
Well, I could name hundreds of acts that could do it and people would care.
Okay.
You just have your passionate fan base, or, you know, that finds out via Twitter if Fish was, you know, they got it. People who love Fish are going to be excited they have a new album out. Or Pearl Jam or REM got back together, recorded an album, and released it unexpectedly. People would be excited.
Gaslight Anthem?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, they're not a big name, but they have a passionate fan base. I'm sure that their fans would be excited to find out, oh my God, new music is here, as opposed to spending 6 months reading about it and waiting for it and hearing about it, and then there's a single. It's kind of a nice way to do it, you know, digitally. You can just get it to the whole world all at once. Beyonce was number one in 104 countries in album sales this week.
Which is kind of amazing because she released the album on a Friday. Normally, albums are released on Tuesday so that you have a whole week's worth of sales ahead of you, so that when those figures are announced, they're quite large. Here, she was able to do it in just 3 days.
Well, that's digital.
Yes.
You know, most album sales would come in that first day. People would know the album was out. They'd rush to the store. They'd buy it. Music fans knew to go to the stores physically on a Tuesday because that's when the new albums were out. When you're a big fan, that's what people did. So, yeah, there'd be sales through the week. But when there was a big audience dying to get that album, they'd line up on Tuesday to buy that album. So she's number one in 104 countries. She sold 600,000 copies in the U.S. I'm going to guess that she sold more than 200,000 copies in 103 countries. So let's assume she sold 1.4 million copies worldwide and that article from the AP was just poorly worded.
Yeah, you know, I just want a slight tweak here to something you mentioned earlier. David Bowie did this in early 2013. He announced on January 8th that he would be releasing an album. It wasn't just released on January 8th. So I think there was still about 4 to 6 weeks before the album was actually released on CD and in digitally, etc. But nobody knew he was even working on an album. So even that slight period, that like 4 to 6 weeks before the album was released, that was just a big surprise to everybody.
Thank you for clarifying. And that is one of the best albums of the year, his best album since the 80s, early 80s, very early 80s. So I haven't listened to Beyonce yet, but I'll do that when I'm back on the road.
Really? You didn't like Reality? Okay.
What?
What? That was the David Bowie album before that, right? Reality was the...
Some of his albums have been okay, but this is his first album that I would put on a best of the year list since, you know, Scary Monsters in the early 80s.
Well, you know, Beyoncé is doing well with her album and the Staples Center, which is the Madison Square Garden of Los Angeles. It opened in 1999. Bruce Springsteen opened the arena. It's where the Lakers play, the Clippers, the LA Kings. So it's right in downtown.
Yeah.
It's Springsteen opened it. He has never been back. He hated it. He thought it was the worst, most gauche, all the press box, not the press boxes, the luxury boxes. He called them the birthday cake arena because everybody was in these boxes.
Up at the top or where are the luxury suites?
They're right in the middle, right in the sweet spot of where you
are. Oh, I hate that.
Yeah. And then everybody else is pushed back. And so he never came back. He never went back to play there. He opened it in 1999. Well, this year, the Staples Center had a record-setting year for all of its concerts, any of its sports shows. They had 53 shows, concerts, music concerts. 35 of them were sellouts in 2013. They sold over 751,000 tickets for a total of $73.8 million. To put that in some perspective, we mentioned that here in the U.S. and Canada, that The Hobbit, Desolation of Smog, made $73 million this weekend. So in an entire year, one arena made that. Off of 53 shows, and of course, merchandising and beer and all that brought in another $7.6 million.
And all of them were 90% sold out or more. So even though 35 were sellouts, they had very strong tickets. So good success for them. Did Beyonce play there, or who's playing there next?
I don't know who's playing.
Taylor Swift played there, yes. One Direction, Depeche Mode. Have you been there? Do you like the venue, or is Bruce right?
I think Bruce is right. If you do not have a good seat in that venue, if you're not on the floor or in that lower rung,
there's a lot of bad seats.
If you're above the luxury boxes, you're screwed. You may as well not even be in the arena.
So if someone says, "Hey, let me give you a free ticket to the One Direction concert," you're in the third tier from the top. You would say, "Big whoop."
Oh yes, I would say that's not a big deal. It is a big whoop, which must mean it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, the music of Led Zeppelin is coming to Spotify. One of the last remaining holdouts to the music streaming service, Led Zeppelin's music began appearing on the site in December. They avoided Spotify for so long because they saw no upside in it. Why make their music available for minuscule revenue? Other holdouts still include the Beatles, AC/DC, Garth Brooks, Bob Seger, Michael Giltz, and myself. So the question for Led Zeppelin is, why now? Why? And is this a big deal or is this a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. There's so much music on Spotify that the fact that a handful of acts are not on there doesn't really matter. The Beatles are the greatest act of all time. Led Zeppelin, one of the biggest selling acts of all time. The fact that they're not on Spotify does not hurt Spotify in the least. So Spotify is fine. So the fact that Led Zeppelin has joined them, they get a press release one day, but so what? But why? Why, in God's name, did they decide to do it? It's not like Spotify suddenly cut them a sweet deal.
No, I have no idea.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, why bother?
There must be something going on there where I wonder what label they're on and whether they're on their own label and they got a part of that.
They control their music, I think, now. Yeah, but I may be wrong about that.
Yeah, I have no idea.
Yeah, it's puzzling, at least. I'd love to know why. So anybody in their camp who knows the reason, you know, let us know anonymously and, you know, clue us into this.
Yes, and then we'll actually let everybody else know in a future episode with your name, you know.
I'm not going to blow the... What,
we'll give you credit. What I'm saying is we'll give you credit, you know?
Oh, nice.
Well, our next story, it's official. The daytime soap opera, The Young and the Restless, is a hit. It's ranked as the number one daytime drama for the 1,300th week in a row, or 25 years and counting. Take that, Today Show and Good Morning America. Okay, number one daytime drama is not such a big crown anymore, but it's averaging just over 5 million viewers, and depending on the cost of the serial, that should be a valuable slice of the pie for years to come. See what we did there? Cereal and pie, and cereal being not breakfast cereal, but pie being an actual food.
Keep going.
Okay, but it's still not a patch on UK hit Coronation Street, which has aired in prime time since 1960 and reaches 8 to 10 million viewers in the much smaller UK market. Is The Young and the Restless's hot streak a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. We take it for granted, but as we saw with Today, these streaks can end. And a lot of the shows have been canceled. Forget not being number one. They don't exist anymore. So that makes it all the more impressive. And it is a big enough viewership. And General Hospital's been rising in the ratings. And Young and the Restless is still on top. And with 5 million people watching, they can make money on it.
The Weinsteins get to play with their Miramax library. Of course, Miramax was the company they founded, named after their mother and father, Mira and Max. The brothers almost bought back their 750-film library from Disney a while back, but decided the $650 million they offered was way too much, only to see it get sold for $663 million. If only they had $13 million more.
Well, they cut way back. They said, never mind, we're not offering you that. We're going to offer you 500 and whatever million.
Oh, okay.
So they got beat bad.
But that group, the group that paid the $663 million, is an investment group with no Hollywood track record. They needed pros with an ability to mine the library for value and found it with the Weinsteins. Up first, a possible movie sequel to Shakespeare in Love and TV spinoffs for Swingers and Flirting with Disaster. Theater is also a possibility, and of course, Shakespeare in Love is headed to the West End already. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal for the Weinsteins. It's nice. It was dumb of them not to buy the library if they thought they could make money off it. But I guess they get all the fun anyway. You know, they get to play with their own properties again and expand them and exploit them in other areas. Why would you buy a film library unless you had the ability to exploit it in every possible way?
Yeah,
you know, I thought the point was to buy it and you license it and you sell it and you do DVDs and streaming and syndication. You sell it around the world and you also exploit it for film and television and theater and books. So I don't get the point of buying it and then having to hire someone else and give them a cut of the profits just to do what you're supposed to do in the first place.
Well, I think because effectively Miramax was purchased by a private equity group.
Yes.
And
I
they
understand.
Had
yeah, do
right,
it.
Right. And they had somebody who knew what they were doing running it. That person was Richard Nanula, who had to resign in June over a sex scandal. So now they had nobody who knew what they were doing
so
running.
So you have one person. Your whole plan is to have one person in charge.
Well, I think that they kind of...
You know, if your company cannot survive the firing of one person who's not even the boss, you've got a problem anyway.
Well, that's true.
Yeah, bad planning.
Welcome to the world of private equity.
So one of their movies is Pulp Fiction, isn't it?
I believe it is. Yes, it is. Miramax 1994. Yes, it is.
And there's news about that, isn't there?
Oh, I see. You're trying to move me onto this story about the National Film Registry. Because
that's right.
Yes, it's added 25 movies. Disney could not have asked for a better tie-in to its new movie, Saving Mr. Banks. That Oscar hopeful is about the creative team behind Disney's live-action classic, Mary Poppins. And now, Mary Poppins has been enshrined on the National Film Registry, or in the National Film Registry. Michael Moore is absolutely relieved that his breakthrough documentary, Roger and Me, is also on the list because he recently discovered that virtually no usable prints of his film still existed. Now, it has a better chance of being preserved forever. Also on the list, The Right Stuff, Forbidden Planet, The Magnificent Seven, The Quiet Man, and as Michael pointed out, Pulp Fiction. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. It is every year. I think it's a generally smart list. There's some I would take issue with, but one of my favorite picks is Midnight, a 1939 film starring Claudette Colbert and Don Ameche. It's a great film. It's a delightful romantic comedy drama. It's just adorable, and it was released in 1939, the greatest year for movies of all time, and yet nobody ever mentions it. When I finally saw it, I was like, oh my God, this is a great film. A script co-written by Billy Wilder, great stars, an absolutely delightful film. I hope this brings more attention to it. One movie that sort of reflects that it's not always just the artistic value or even at all the artistic value of a movie, but also its social and historical importance. That would be Wild Boys of the Road from 1933. It's actually a pretty good B-movie. I don't know if it counts as a B-movie, but it's actually a pretty good little movie. It's directed by William Wellman, and it's about kids riding the rails during the Depression. It's got this weird plotline about kids who just left home to try and fend for themselves. And historians say that at one point, about 250,000 minors, kids, children, were wandering the country on the rails. Basically, what would happen is either they'd lose their home or their parents would die, or kids would take it upon themselves to leave home. They'd say, there's too many kids, too many mouths to feed. My folks can't do it. And they would just leave one day and try and fend for themselves because they knew their parents couldn't take care of all their children. And so you had hundreds of thousands of children going around the country. This movie is in part about that. And bringing attention to that historical incident is one of the reasons why it made the cut. But The Right Stuff is a great movie. And I love the fact that they highlighted the spot on editing because we have a connection to the editor of that film or one of the editors. So it's great to see.
We do?
Well, a friend of mine's father worked on it.
Well, this next story, maybe he can figure out a way to edit this next story then, because I don't know how you have a sequel to The Bible. And NBC has snagged the sequel rights to the smash hit miniseries The Bible. And no, it's not the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's called AD, which follows immediately after the crucifixion to show what happened to Mary, the apostles, and others in the aftermath of the killing of Jesus. Since The Bible was a massive hit, producers Mark Burnett and Roma Downey have placed a string of events, what old people call miniseries, by the way, with CBS doing their miniseries about the Siege of Masada. Spoiler alert, it's not an upbeat movie, it's a downer. And NBC also doing Plymouth, a look at the Pilgrims in America, which is sure to include lots of, well, praying. Big deal or big what, Michael?
It's a big deal for the History Channel. Why were they not able to get the sequel to their miniseries? What did they do wrong?
I don't know. Poor negotiations, poor business. That
is a disaster of epic proportions. Maybe Mark Burnett and Roma Downey, he's done a lot of stuff with NBC and other networks. Maybe he wanted to go away from the History Channel anyway. Maybe he only went to them. But when it worked and it was a big hit, they should have had that sequel. That's a disaster for them, I think. The Dove Keepers, which is that miniseries about Masada. Don't forget the miniseries called Masada, which is a great miniseries from the 70s or early 80s. I really loved it as a kid, even though it has a downer ending, if you know what happened. But that was a really good miniseries. I imagine that means it'll come out on DVD again, or we'll get some attention to it once the new project comes around. So that's a big, big deal for history, and it's in a bad sense because they lost out on what should have been their baby.
So it's both the History Channel and history itself.
That's right. Then, and maybe they could make a secular sequel. They could call it CE, instead of AD, which is very politically incorrect.
Okay.
A little Common Era joke there. All right, never mind.
Well, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame announced the class of 2014, and progressive rock fans are heartbroken. The Hall said no to yes, at least for now. Making the cut? Peter Gabriel, Hall & Oates, the most successful duo of all time, we might point out. Kiss, the most successful makeup artists of all time. Nirvana, Cat Stevens, and Michael will be glad to know, Linda Ronstadt as well. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal for them. I think they were conservative this year. They didn't include a lot of people, so that's always good. You want to maintain the quality. I don't get Kiss. I understand how they're, I guess, influential in the way of their production and their concerts, but I think musically they fall pretty short. They've got a couple great songs, and that's about it. Cat Stevens, I think that's pretty iffy, but maybe it's like, hey, it's our first Muslim in the Hall of Fame. Well, that's probably not true. Was Isaac? There's probably some other artists who converted to Islam, but certainly one of the most prominent. I don't know if his body of work stands up. But in general, a good roster of people. Hall & Oates, absolutely. Peter Gabriel, Linda Ronstadt, good to see. So, and Nirvana, of course, was a given.
Now, Amazon announced the top 20 books sold on its site in 2013. And since Amazon is the number one bookseller, it's a good look at future trends. Notably, only one title in the top 20, the business book memoir Lean In by Sheryl Sandberg, the Facebook, chief operating officer, sold more print copies than ebooks. So that book, more popular digitally, that kind of makes sense.
More popular physically. That's the only book that sold more in print, into physical copies, than digital. So 19 of the books sold more ebooks than print books.
Isn't that what I just said? No, I guess I said the other way around. Okay, yes, you're right. It makes no sense at all. So I take everything back. It makes no sense. But needless to say, Sheryl Sandberg, Lean In.
Okay.
Three of the top 20 were self-published. And so, Michael, congratulations. I guess your book is now a big hit seller. No. And as always, the best way to have a bestseller is to have previously written a bestseller. The list is dominated by name brands like Dan Brown, John Grisham, and J.K. Rowling. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. There's a lot of trends in here. And anyone who thinks ebooks are washed up, or, oh, the sales are slowing down, or it's going to settle down into a small... No. More ebooks will be sold than physical books. I think that's the trend here this year for the bestsellers. That's just going to keep continuing as we go farther into the future, as more and more books become available digitally, because most books that were printed are not available digitally. Throughout history, most books were simply not, they haven't made the transfer. Just like albums were lost that were only on LP, didn't make the jump to CD, there are a lot of books that still have not made the jump to digital. And so as more and more new books come out, as more and more the majority of books people want to buy are available digitally, you're going to see that trend continue. 19 out of the top 20. Now, I know it's Amazon and they're tied into the Kindle, so they have a lot to ride on selling people digital books. But they are the number one store in the country for ebooks, for books in general. So that's a trend that's going to grow and continue.
Well, now I'm going to throw a little experiment in here.
I don't like change.
Well, let's just see how this goes on what may become a regular segment in which we review the previous week's entertainment-related press announcements and simply ask whether the proposed projects they promote are a good idea or a bad idea in a segment we call Good Idea, Bad Idea. So, Michael, the whole...
Which is radically different from Big Deal, Big Whoop.
Well, yes. Not okay. Totally different, but...
Okay, let's see what happens. I'll try to keep an open mind.
Okay, now the goal, Michael, is to just...
I got it. Be quick. We're going to... The rapid fire way that Big Deal, Big Whoop was supposed to be.
That is correct. That is absolutely correct.
So it became Chatty Cathy's. Okay.
Yes. Okay, the first one. NBC says it will put on a show again, a live concert again, much like they did with The Sound of Music, which reached 18.6 million viewers. They announced this week, surprising nobody, that they are going to do it again, possibly around the holiday time. Good idea, bad idea?
Well, good idea. Success begets success. They say they can't do it for 10 years in a row, but certainly they can do it for a couple years at least. They expect maybe diminishing returns, but I don't know. I think it could become an annual tradition.
I agree with you. It is a good idea simply because of the curiosity factor. Maybe they can finally find a something that actually is culturally relevant and becomes more, instead of more curiosity, actually becomes artistic in nature.
Right.
The next story comes from The Hollywood Reporter, who reports that Ari Folman, the director of the Oscar-nominated Waltz with Bashir and The Congress, will adapt Anne Frank's life and diary as a family animated feature. Good idea or bad idea?
A family animated feature.
A family-oriented animated feature.
Well, let's see how it could be anything else. She's in an attic. It's a good idea. Anything that expands animation, you can tell any story with animation. He brought that to the documentary film with Waltz with Bashir. Others had done it before as well, but he pushed that idea. And animation can tell dramas, comedy, sci-fi, romance. There's no reason it should just be fairy tales and fantasy films for children. It should be for everything, and that's great.
I think it's a good idea also, if only because if there's anybody that can pull this off, it's Ari Folman.
Really? He's the greatest animated director of all time? He's the one for you?
No, just that having seen The Congress, which I thought was an okay film, not great, and Waltz with Bashir, he's able to take serious stories, not, as you say, fairy tales and fantasies, and actually convert them to an animated film quite well.
Okay. Next. Ralph Bakshi is grinding his teeth.
Well, okay, but I don't know that Ralph Bakshi is still making movies, so... that said, let's move on to our next story here from the New York Times. Heathers, the film, is being turned into a musical, which will play off-Broadway in March. This is an adaptation of the 1989 dark comedy about high school mean girls that added What's Your Damage and the memorable lines, you know, other memorable lines to the teen lexicon. It's going to have an off-Broadway commercial run. Good idea or bad idea, Michael?
Bad idea. It should have been Clueless. Clueless is happier and funnier and sweeter.
I would agree with you. It's a bad idea. That was a film. It was a cult classic, not necessarily hugely commercially successful at the time, became successful on home video, and I think it was of its time. There's no reason to try and create that as a musical today. Speaking of creating musicals out of films, the LA Times is reporting that Bull Durham will be turned into a musical which will debut in Atlanta in 2014. This is a stage musical based on the popular 1988 movie Bull Durham, which is now in the works, and I guess September 2014 is when it will debut. It was the script was written by Ron Shelton, who directed and wrote the original movie. The songs are by Susan Werner. Good idea or bad idea, Michael?
Bad idea. It should have been Field of Dreams. I didn't even know this was going to happen, but that's a show that's stirring and heartwarming and touching and loving. It's a great idea for a musical. Bull Durham is foul and profane. It's like, instead of damn Yankees, it's goddamn Yankees. It's G-damn Yankees.
Yeah.
So it's not a family-friendly show done well and right. It's, you know, sex and romp and cursing nonstop. But you know what? It's a great movie. It could be a good musical. Who knows? You know, it depends on the talent. But to me, if I was going to pick a baseball movie from that era, it would be Field of Dreams. That's the one that would stir people's hearts.
I agree. Now our next story, is from Vulture. Baz Luhrmann.
My God, we're like, what's that show on CNN called? Crossfire, but without any crossfire.
Yeah, we're both on the same side. Yes. Well, our final story here is Baz Luhrmann, the filmmaker, and Sean Ryan are planning to do a TV drama set at the dawn of the hip hop era, according to Vulture's Joseph Adalian. Luhrmann is teaming up with Ryan, who of course is the producer of The Shield and Terriers and others, and playwright Stephen Adley. I don't know how you pronounce his last name, Gurgis.
That's about right.
Who wrote the Mother?
Can't say that.
Blanker with the hat, and it's an epic music-filled period drama exploring the dawn of the hip hop era as seen through the eyes of two young New Yorkers. Executives at Netflix, Amazon, and FX have all heard the pitch for the project this week. Other cable networks, including Showtime, are also said to be taking meetings on the idea, according to Vulture. Good idea or bad idea, Michael?
It's not an idea yet. Hasn't even come to the pilot stage.
It's a no idea.
The big problem is getting the rights to the music. As long as you have the rights to the music, it's a good idea. If you don't, it's a bad idea.
Okay. Well, that brings us to Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. This week, it's kind of a lawsuit-a-palooza. We have all these stories about lawsuits. We have the Weinsteins filing suit, and this is probably the big one here. They're filing suit against Time Warner over all of these Hobbit sequels.
Well, they're not sequels. The Hobbit has been turned into three films, and the Weinsteins say, hey, we get X percent of the Hobbit movies, and you're making three, and we want money for all three. And Time Warner says, no. Those are sequels. You don't have rights to the sequels. You only have rights to the actual movie we make from The Hobbit. To which I would say, oh, yeah, I'm looking at the book.
Yeah.
And that book is in the second and third movie. So if you want to make the first movie and say that's the only Hobbit movie, that's fine. But then you can't release the second and the third one. So this is just going to courts. This is just, we want more money. They want to pretend they don't deserve it. It's tricky. Nobody anticipated they turn it into three films. But,
Well, actually, I disagree. I think somebody did anticipate that they would turn it into three films. You might be asking, well, what the heck do the Weinsteins, who were running Miramax at the time, have to do?
They had a cut of The Hobbit at one point.
Well, they owned the rights to The Hobbit. And this comes from the 1998, in August, it was signed, from the quit claim, meaning they were turning over the rights. No. I'm not going to read it, but I'm just going to say that in Clause C, subparagraph 1, one of the things that they said, and this is where the History Channel messed up, one of the points here was that they considered anything a picture having to do with The Hobbit if the events or the incidents in the picture are primarily the events, incidents from the book, and the picture has both the characters Smaug the Dragon and Thorin the Dwarf or other characters that would serve their story functions. Or Bilbo Baggins. Guess what? It's got all of them. It's part of The Hobbit. So this is an open and shut case as far as I'm concerned. Though I'm not the lawyer, I don't necessarily...
For
the Weinsteins, absolutely.
They say we fulfilled the agreement because we made that movie. Now we're making more movies. They happen to have the same stuff in it, but so what?
Right. They say, yeah, you got $12.5 million on The Hobbit. No, that's what you got.
Go away.
Right. So the Weinsteins are saying, okay, how about this? We will take the last half of the story of The Hobbit, which you didn't film, and you can't use that. Unfortunately, it's your second movie. So, which has no ending, but don't get me started. Now, ironically, that is Time Warner that is kind of preventing them from, preventing the Weinsteins from collecting any revenue off of the last two films of The Hobbit.
How is that ironic?
Well, here's the thing, and this is a little aside. I was reading this week in the LA Times about Time Warner CEO Jeff Bewkes. He was talking about VOD at this conference, the UBS Global Media and Communications Conference in New York last Tuesday. And this comes from the LA Times. During the session, an investor asked Bewkes how the company's regional sports networks in Los Angeles were doing. Those networks are owned by Time Warner Cable.
Time Warner Cable. Different company.
That's right. Not Time Warner. And Bewkes responded that he often gets emails from people complaining about their cable service. Quote, they think I was the guy who missed the installation appointment. So to that, I say, we're not the only ones who make that mistake.
And how did they get his direct line or email?
I have no idea. But
right,
I will say, while the Weinsteins is an open and shut, kind of a clear case, This Frank Darabont case is not open and shut. It's a little trickier.
I don't know about that.
Well, director Frank Darabont, he's suing for tens of millions of dollars, he says, he is owed due to his role in the creation of The Walking Dead, that big popular television show. It was always assumed that Darabont was overwhelmed by the pace of television, since he's, you know, normally a film director, and that is what led to his abrupt departure right after the series became a massive hit after the first season. But his new lawsuit implies that AMC fired him because they were already butting heads over profit participation. Darabont says he hasn't received a single penny from his cut of the show, arguably the biggest hit on TV right now. In fact, as of September 2012, 2 years after its premiere, he says AMC claims the show is $49 million in the red. I'd love to see the accounting on that. In part, Darabont blames a sweetheart deal with the network underpaying itself for the right to air the show. Another example of the dangers of vertical integration, at least for outsiders. So,
I don't know if this isn't, I mean, it's not open and shut. Obviously, there'll be a long trial and it'll probably be settled before it gets to, you know, a jury or to a judge making a ruling. But, you know, he has documents showing AMC saying that they were only going to charge themselves 65% of the cost of an episode. No matter what happened, no matter what the episode cost, they would only pay back 65%. So if it costs, you know, $2 million to make, you'd only get $1.2 million or whatever it might be. So they were guaranteeing that every episode would put them further and further into debt, technically on the accounting books, which meant there'd never be any profit. I mean, he hasn't had a penny from the show in after 2 years of it being on the air. Give me a break.
And they've got spinoffs. So if it's such a failure, okay, if it's such a failure.
He wants a piece of the spinoffs. He wants a piece of the merchandising. He wants a, not the merchandise, but he wants a piece of The Talking Dead, the spinoff TV talk show that follows the show. So this will be settled before it goes to a jury.
Well, because if it does go to a jury, it would set precedent.
We get to see the books.
Yeah, well, and it would set precedent. It would basically say, some judge would say, or some jury would say, you can't do that. You can't charge yourself only 65%, cook the books, and basically say you're not making any money when indeed you're making so much money and it's so profitable that you have all these spinoffs. You have talk shows about the show itself, and then you have narrative spinoffs. You can't do that and then not pay people.
And the fascinating thing is he says his profit participation would have fully vested at the end of season two. They fired him just as season two began airing. That does seem very suspicious. We certainly all scratched our heads at the time, wondering what the heck was going on.
Well, that's true. And if you go back in time and listen to Showbiz Sandbox from around that time, you'll hear us kind of going, what were they thinking? But, you know, we thought it was creative differences at the time, as did everybody. And now we're seeing, well, maybe it was more monetary. Speaking of money, here's a story. And this is a story really about accounting when you get right down to it. Paramount, it has settled, as all of these cases do, their big lawsuit over this Slate financing where they took out all these loans and they tried to cut their risk with a firm in the 1990s who invested in some of their films along with J.P. Morgan. And I guess they decided, you know what, rather than try and prevent this firm from collecting, we're just going to settle the case.
Basically, J.P. Morgan was the crazy people because they said, they told investors, we've got this new way. You're never going to lose money on investing in Hollywood. You'll always make money.
That's right. Which should
tell you, that's not true. You're not always going to make money on anything, ever. And if somebody tells you that, even a big company like JP Morgan, run the other way.
That's true. And they settled this case over these you know, Slate financing. And I guess the plaintiffs in this case, being content partners in JP Morgan, were saying, hey, you owe us some money, Paramount. And Paramount was saying, no, we don't. And you guys cut a deal on the side. And it got very complicated and kind of very twisted. In the end, basically, nobody wanted the books to be opened. It was settled out of court.
Well, maybe someday we'll come back to the story if we actually find out who won and who lost.
Well, it won't be on this episode because that kind of concludes this week's episode of Showbiz Sandbox. We will have an episode next week just before Christmas if you're around, Michael.
Oh, we are going to have an episode next week.
Yes. We're making this up as we go.
Okay, well, Sperling has spoken. All right, I'm down for it. We'll have to do it on Monday, though, early.
Okay.
All right.
In the meantime, you can subscribe to Showbiz Sandbox in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, wherever they give podcasts out for free and aggregate podcasts. You can subscribe to our show, and we do urge you to rate, review the show on any of those podcast aggregators. It does help us out. You can also follow us on Twitter, where our username is Showbiz Sandbox, or like us on Facebook, where our page is can be found at Showbiz Sandbox. So again, just search for Showbiz Sandbox and up will come. We place links to news stories throughout the week, and you can also submit news stories through the Facebook page for us to cover. Or you could email us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Links to all of the stories we talked about on today's show can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com, and that's where you'll find all those ways to subscribe to us or to follow us or to like us or, you know, all of our information is on showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their own website, whoismgmt.com. And Michael Giltz has a website. Michael, this week it is...
McDonald's Wi-Fi does not reach the parking lot. .com.
Okay. Well, if you can't find any of Michael's work and writing on that particular website, try michaelgiltz.com or, of course, bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.